Chapter 11. Mixter, Munch, and Phineas. While Jake Applebaum provided one example of the Cult of the Dead Cow's negative influence, he was not the only one. Edward Snowden had pulled back the veil and showed the symbiosis between Western intelligence agencies and big technology companies. CDC blood had infused both sides of that relationship, and both had lost moral luster. But soon, CDC's descendants would be playing on all sides of an increasing complex struggle among spies in many countries, their technology suppliers, and the enemies of those suppliers, both those opposed for moral reasons, like the Citizen Lab, and those opposed for geopolitical reasons. Then, too, there would be anonymous vigilantes with motives hard to discern. For the most part, they remained hidden, protected either by the technological sophistication of the very best hackers or by the tools provided by a nation-state. The root cause of all this mess was the deeper integration of the nearly indefensible internet into all major economies during the tech industry's amoral drift of the 2000s. As that happened, it was inevitable that big governments would use security weaknesses to their advantage. It did not have to follow that they would ignore basic defense research, but they did that too. So what CDC had called out as a looming disaster at the turn of the millennium, shoddy software, uneducated buyers, and disengaged officials, had gotten much worse over the next decade. Instead of acting perhaps in concert to improve the security of what was driving economic growth for everyone, governments were supporting a dark market for knowledge about specific software flaws and techniques for exploiting them in order to spy. For some governments, the top targets were human rights advocates, journalists, and minority party politicians. The people Laird Brown and his ilk had set out to protect were now in a much worse position than a decade before. "When I was young, there was something fun about the insecurity of the internet," complained Signal inventor Moxie Marlinspike. "It opened up possibilities for anyone inventive enough to take advantage, despite their underdog status. Now internet insecurity is used by people I don't like against people I do. The government against the people." Of course, many of those who ended up supplying tools to the wrong people began with good intentions, including an early supporter of Laird's Hacktivismo project named Martin Munch. As German hacker Kamal Ackman, called Mixter, was writing the 6-4 proxy system for Laird, the latter-day CDC member had landed a job at a Munich startup called Cypher Labs, which was trying to develop an encrypted email system. Kamal helped get Laird a job there as well, and he looked for colleagues at the company who might volunteer for Hacktivismo. Kamal thought he'd found a perfect candidate in Munch, an intense and brilliant teenager. Kamal added him to the Hacktivismo mailing list, which had about 20 steady contributors and 10 times as many quiet readers who lurked and learned. Kamal also introduced the young man to others he knew in the Berlin scene, centering around the Chaos Computer Club. "Martin was an idealist," Kamal said. "He had my full trust. But Munch wanted to be a rock star, and that also influenced his trajectory. Munch told Kamal that he wanted to help the police catch the worst of the worst, the makers of child pornography, and he left Cypher to go work on software that he said would help. Because he had recruited and mentored Munch and introduced him to human rights-oriented hackers around Berlin, Kamal felt guilty for what happened next. I put Martin on there. I am partly responsible for his career," Kamal said. "I personally found him a bit strange." Laird said he still regards Munch as a friend, one who lost control of a project due to a struggle inside the company he started, not because he had chosen an immoral path. Whatever the reason, Munch's system became the next flashpoint in the fight over hacking, security, and privacy. As with WikiLeaks, the debate would go beyond professionals and engage the media and general public in a discussion about the balance of power between governments and average citizens. Though hunting from behind blinds, Russia had been driving a significant chunk of that debate, probably with Munch, and definitely with the dumping of hacking tools used by the National Security Agency, While CDC has started blending political motives and security work with the Hong Kong Blondes, 2 decades of increasing geopolitical influence and hacktivist causes since then have made it hard to tease apart the real actors and purpose behind many public hacks. Munch's modest program developed into spyware called FinFisher or FinSpy. In Kamal's thinking, Back Orifice 2000 inspired the project, and Munch might have adapted some code from that open source effort. But Christian Ryu was aiming only at Windows computers. Munch's FinFisher targeted Windows and Apple computers, Android and Apple phones, other devices, and most operating systems. There were other differences too. Anybody could use Back Orifice 2000, but those users needed to find a working exploit, or a gullible victim, to get it installed. The company selling Munch's FinFisher, called Gamma Group, also provided the tricks to get it installed on the devices. Munch headed product development in Gamma's Munich office. Gamma also had a headquarters in the UK and affiliated companies in Singapore and other countries, which ostensibly sold only to established government agencies. Kamal heard about Munch's connection to Gamma in 2008. In 2011, activists infiltrated the trade shows known as the Wiretapper's Ball and emerged with a 60-page Gamma catalog. FinFisher is the cutting-edge offensive IT intrusion portfolio on the market today, it declared. The portfolio included impressive spy programs aimed at smartphones. Those were very hard to detect, could be operated remotely, and would not only capture voice calls and electronic contact lists, but also turn the phones into constant surveillance recorders. USB thumb drives and phones with spy programs that were very hard to detect could be operated remotely and would not only capture voice calls and electronic contact lists, but turn phones into surveillance recorders. The same year, during the Arab Spring, Egyptian rebels discovered a similar pitch was given to the brutal State Security Investigation Service. Gamma said that the deal hadn't gone through, that it complied with export laws, and that it only sold to governments targeting criminals. But activists suspected repressive regimes, including those under widespread sanctions like Sudan, were using FinFisher against law-abiding dissidents. In 2012, Bloomberg News obtained suspected infected emails sent to Bahraini activists and handed them off to the Laird-inspired Citizen Lab. A Citizen Lab team led by a Google security expert dove deep. For the first time, they established that the infections were connected to Gamma, how the infections worked, and that data from the victims would be sent to the Bahraini government's telecommunications company. Citizen Lab found FinFisher servers in dozens of countries, including the UAE, Ethiopia, and Vietnam, where bloggers were being targeted. Technological tricks used by the company included intervening in software update processes and using exploits for Adobe's Flash video software. 2 years later, someone hacked Gamma badly. The hacker opened a parody Twitter account at Gamma Group PR and tweeted links to stolen files with source code, client lists, and other damaging information, including a chart showing that the largest number of visitors to the company's customer support pages had shifted from the Netherlands, France, and China in 2009 to China and the U.S. in 2014. The tech press had a field day. Activist researchers rejoiced, and nonprofits filed complaints with authorities that severely hurt the company. In 2015, at Gamma Group PR came back to life to announce that it had also hacked Gamma's best-known rival, Italian company Hacking Team. As LulzSec had with HB Gary Federal's Aaron Barr, the hackers delighted in pointing out the company's poor security. Once more, they dumped source code, client lists that showed apparent sanctions violations, and embarrassing emails. Hacking Team tools had been used against Ethiopian journalists and other innocents, including some inside the U.S. The person controlling the At Gamma Group PR account, who referred to himself as Phineas Fisher, said in a later interview with Vice that he had gone after both companies out of moral outrage. I just read the Citizen Lab reports on Finn Fisher and Hacking Team and thought, that's fucked up. And I hacked them, he explained. Hopefully, it can at least set them back a bit and give some breathing room to the people being targeted with their software. In that interview conducted over electronic chat in July 2016, Phineas used informal English and alluded to the anti-sec movement from years earlier. Describing himself as an anarchist revolutionary, Phineas published tutorials and a manifesto encouraging others to hack their oppressors. In another interview a month earlier, Phineas admitted to hacking a Catalan police union in the Spanish region that includes Barcelona and posting the home addresses of more than 5,000 officers. He called it a small strike against power and denied being Spanish or speaking either Spanish or Catalan. All the same, that very local target fueled speculation that Phineas was a politically minded hacker from the region. Phineas's stunts took the original anti-sec movement and H.B. Gary breach in exactly the direction that previous hacktivists who were willing to break the law would have gone. He used his knowledge of how the world really works to make it harder for technology to be applied for oppression. After Phineas came leaks of purloined material from Cellebrite, an Israeli tech forensics company that breaks into phones for law enforcement, and from the makers of FlexiSpy, spyware used by parents to track children and by romantic partners to snoop on each other. Cellebrite had been reported by some publications as the company that helped the FBI finally break into the Apple iPhone of a terrorist who killed public employees in San Bernardino, California, after Apple refused to do it. The FlexiSpy hackers paid tribute to Phineas and published an updated security and how to hack guide for fans. If you're a hacker, hack back, they wrote. If you're an ordinary person, stay safe. Watch how things progress and see what people are saying about how to detect FlexiSpy and protect yourselves. If you're a spouseware vendor, we're coming for you. Stop. Rethink your life. Kill your company and be a better person. Otherwise, you'll be seeing us soon. Gabriella Coleman, the anonymous chronicler teaching at McGill University, called the trend the birth of public interest hacking. And it is likely that at least some of what grew to more than a half dozen spyware breaches stemmed from moral objections to the vendor's conduct. All the same, it is worth taking another look at instigator Phineas in the wake of the hack of the Democratic National Committee and publication of NSA tools. The basics of the DNC breach and others against Democratic Party officials during the 2016 U.S. elections have been clearly established by U.S. investigators, including those working for Special Counsel Robert Mueller. One DNC breach came shortly after the publication of a Pulitzer-winning series of articles about the leaked Panama Papers, which showed that Putin's friends were stashing billions of dollars overseas. Putin blamed Clinton for the underlying leak of an offshore law firm's files. Given that U.S. intelligence had indeed debated exposing Putin's corruption, he may have been right that it was a CIA operation. Though Assange tried to cast doubts about who provided WikiLeaks with stolen emails, Russian intelligence clearly drove the attack on the DNC and related hacks. The persona Guccifer II, which shopped some stolen DNC data while claiming to be Romanian, once forgot to use a virtual private network to connect and revealed his true location at the GRU, Russia's Military Intelligence Service. Russia also arranged for the publication of emails and other documents by WikiLeaks and others. The major NSA breach has not been tied up as neatly. In August 2016, just weeks after Phineas stopped bragging, a group calling itself the Shadow Brokers appeared on Twitter and began dropping not only vulnerabilities in Microsoft's Windows, Cisco routers, and other programs, but also working exploits, all of which had been held by the NSA. Most of the information came from late 2013, after Edward Snowden had left the agency, meaning that there was another mole, or a hack of agency hardware, or a careless employee who had been hacked. Shadow brokers kept going for months, Some of the tricks it disclosed were then used by others, including the presumed North Korean distributors of badly crafted ransomware called WannaCry, which shuttered hospitals and other facilities around the planet in 2017. Eventually, two NSA employees were charged with bringing classified files home. At least one of them had been running Kaspersky antivirus on his personal computer. That was cause for special concern, because the Israelis had broken into Kaspersky's networks in 2015. Inside, they had seen that the software was used to search for classified U.S. documents, and they had warned the Americans. The consensus in the intelligence agencies was that the Russians had obtained at least some of the shadow broker's information in that manner. The disclosures badly hurt Kaspersky, which had enjoyed a remarkable run, publicly exposing high-end U.S. malware, starting with the Stuxnet virus, which had knocked out Iranian nuclear centrifuges. Kaspersky admitted it had taken some secret files from a U.S. government employee, though it claimed that it had deleted them. The U.S. banned it from federal government use. The Russians had the motive to steal U.S. hacking tools, the means to do it, and the opportunity. Russia was also one of the few suspects with so many of its own tools that it could afford to dump those of the U.S. instead of hoarding them for its own use. The timing is particularly interesting. Since the NSA dumps began in August 2016, 2 months after the DNC breach was disclosed, Russia created chaos and distraction inside the agencies best able to find the source of the DNC hack and strike back, helping to paralyze the Obama administration and mute its response. With that history in mind, it is worth revisiting the identity of Phineas Fisher. Missing from virtually all of the mainstream media coverage was the fact that Gamma Group and hacking team generally did not sell to Russia or its closest allies. They sold hacking tools to the West, and Phineas stole them and dumped them in public, just as the shadow brokers would do starting weeks later with the NSA. In addition, Gamma Group held special interest for Kaspersky. Two former Kaspersky employees told me that the company had lifted inactive code from a Gamma computer after someone there foolishly installed their antivirus software. And then there are the matters of Phineas's choice of other targets, and what we now know to be Russia's strategy of sowing division in the European Union, in the U.S., and in other strategic countries. An attack on the Catalan police union would fit with pitting regions against the central Spanish government, which emerged as a Russian goal in 2017 when the Catalan government defied a Madrid court order and held a referendum on seceding. After Spain ordered the Catalan leader removed, the loyalty of the police was of enormous importance. It would be surprising for a highly skilled, willfully law-breaking, and morally driven hacker to take down both Gamma Group and hacking team and still get seriously involved with Spanish political issues. At a minimum, you would expect someone with that combination to be Spanish. But that is not all Phineas did. He also hacked the data of innocent Turkish citizens during a period of confrontation between Russia and Turkey and made that data public. Though this context was missing from most of the hack's coverage, Russia and Turkey had been in an escalating confrontation since Turkey had shot down a Russian plane, killing its pilot in late 2015. Over the next half year, Putin increased pressure on Turkish President Recep Erdogan with sanctions on Turkish food imports and a ban on sales of Turkish tourist packages to Russians. At the same time, Erdogan was losing popularity in the West as he cracked down on the media and activists. Meanwhile, Russia and Turkey were pursuing different goals in neighboring Syria, Russia's client state. Erdogan had to choose between Washington and Moscow, and he eventually opted for the latter. Even though the downed plane was believed to have been in Turkish airspace, Erdogan folded and wrote to Putin in June 2016, "I once again express my sympathy and profound condolences to the family of the Russian pilot who was killed, and I apologize to them." Erdogan had planned to purge the military, and that triggered a coup attempt in July 2016. It emerged later. Russia was the first outside nation to condemn the coup, suggesting that the alliance had been firmed up beforehand. But many pieces were in play at once, and it would make sense for Russia to have been interested in weakening Erdogan's hand by exposing his party's followers to scrutiny in the same way that exposing the Catalan police officers' personal information could have been useful in stirring the pot. Perhaps Russia was betting on both sides of the Erdogan military conflict, so that whoever emerged victorious would be in its debt. In any case, it would make more sense for Russia to publish such information than it would for a politically minded hacker in Spain or elsewhere. Phineas's explanation for what he was trying to do and what went wrong, on the other hand, makes little sense. I hacked AKP, the ruling party in Turkey, because I support the society Kurdish people are trying to build in Rojava and Bakur, and they're being attacked by Turkey, Phineas posted in July. He then added a complex story for why sensitive information was published about ordinary people. According to Phineas, he had hacked into the party servers and shared a historical file of emails with people in the rest of regions, asking them what he should do with the access. The emails themselves were not interesting. They included people asking for potholes to be fixed or for help finding work. There was nothing from Erdogan or his inner circle. Then there was a miscommunication between some of them, Phineas wrote, and one of the people gave the dump to WikiLeaks. He said that even though the person who had relayed the files realized the mistake and asked WikiLeaks not to publish, it did so anyway. But Phineas then published more files himself, including a database of ordinary AKP members and, worse, a database of almost all the adult women in Turkey, along with cell phone numbers and addresses for many of them. Those databases were copied and reposted by people like UK security activist Thomas White, who tweeted as @CthulhuSec, and had won a measure of controversial fame by posting the fruits of many large hacks. WikiLeaks tweeted links to those databases, which allowed millions of women to be reached by stalkers, further angering previous admirers of Phineas, such as Electronic Frontier Foundation activist Eva Galperin. Who's that behind the not-so-great leak of Turkish emails? Galperin wrote on Twitter. It's at Gamma Group PR, whose previous work I have enjoyed. 3 months later, White stopped posting links to leaked data, complaining that the motives of the hackers had gotten more crass. 3 months after that, Phineas told Vice he was retiring his moniker and that he would take a break from all hacking. So now we have a hacker who is extraordinarily skilled, ethically driven, and broad enough in his thinking to go after both the rank-and-file regional police in Barcelona and the Turkish ruling party, yet sloppy enough to expose the phone numbers of millions of women in a patriarchal society to the general public, along with those of ordinary party members, just as they become uniquely at risk if exposed. It seems unlikely. Even without the relationship with WikiLeaks, an equally logical explanation would be that Phineas is a Russian intelligence project. Indeed, that was Washington's private conclusion. Within U.S. intelligence, it's generally assumed to be Russians, said Jim Lewis, a well-connected longtime senior State Department official and negotiator on global internet issues. It's consistent with Russian activities in other areas. If the Russians did try to ruin Gamma Group and Hacking Team, they had their own tools for spying on citizens and enemies and were merely making life harder for governments in the West. That doesn't necessarily mean that those companies didn't deserve exposure. Kamal, for one, didn't hesitate before applauding the leak, even if it came from the Kremlin and hurt his old friend Munch. I'm really happy about it, he said of the exposed Gamma tools. They should be leaked, and they should be burned. Even if Phineas isn't Russian, a look at the bigger picture is warranted. We have to accept that hacktivism is often polluted by geopolitics, as in fact it was with Laird, and that such influence can be impossible to detect. If that weren't alarming enough, there is a deeper realization. The great powers of the world contest each other in public and in secret, using arms and money, diplomacy and spying, false activism, and public relations. At the same time, most governments have similar interests against their own people. None of them want their citizens to be able to communicate in secret, not even the United States. In 2018, the FBI was still railing against the ability of people to use encryption that vendors cannot break, and congressional allies were still threatening legislation to outlaw such security. Kamal saw the trend toward greater government power against the individual as so dispiriting that in 2011, he left the security industry for years. Like others in CDC, he felt the best remaining hope for preserving individual freedoms lay with the biggest vendors, like Apple and Google, who could, in theory, play the major governments off one another and protect users in the process. And with private startups like Signal, that feel they are chasing things more important than money. Apple was clearly a battlefront. It was home to at-stake veterans Wendell Snyder, David Litchfield, and Rob Beck, along with many more CDC kindred spirits. Some of them helped stave off the FBI's attempt to force it to crack the San Bernardino iPhone. Apple argued that the government could probably find a way to break the phone on its own, and that making it write a new program would be compelled speech, which has been found unconstitutional. The FBI was losing when it suddenly found an unnamed contractor with a zero day that could do the job and drop the case. Google was another war zone stocked with CDC members and admirers. It had realized the NSA was the enemy after Snowden documents showed the agency had been breaking into its networks overseas where it did not need court approval. Google moved to encrypt far more deeply, even if it maintained the ability to recover all users' emails. The two companies also fought against proposed government-mandated backdoors and bans on end-to-end encryption, which by 2018 were popping up around the globe. There was still fighting to be done inside the big companies. But leading lights in the encryption fight were also spending more time helping the startups. Others were beginning to think more about the meaning of free speech when the immediate problem in many countries was not the inability to speak, but the propensity to get drowned out by manufactured voices directed by governments and big economic forces. Laird and the others in CDC were appalled at the likes of Gamma Group and sorry to have played any role in Munch's rise. But while they may have cheered Phineas on, they were not interested in breaking the laws themselves. As the hacktivist battlegrounds evolved toward hacking, leaking, and information warfare, they had to find other ways to help. After Laird returned from India to Germany, he went back to work for the former CEO of Cypher, the now-failed encrypted email provider that had also employed Kamal and Munch. The ex-CEO, Erikos Pitsos, had an idea for a platform for serious debate he called Kialo. The software guided discussion by showing decision trees that listed which followers had agreed with which points. Moderators rejected unhelpful comments. Pitsos funded the project himself, aiming to create a collaborative reasoning tool, and Harvard and other universities tried out private versions for classrooms. It wasn't going to get rid of the bots and trolls on Twitter, but at least it was positive. On the side, Laird began writing a book on information warfare. Some sympathetic to U.S. cyber operations, including Mudge, also saw a clear ethical case for authorized offensive work. They decided that hacking in order to spy, to prepare the battlefield in case of further conflict, and to conduct highly targeted destructive attacks, as with Stuxnet, was vastly preferable to sending in bombs and troops. Others in CDC, looking at the mixed motives as geopolitical priorities ascended, opted to go back to basics on defense. By making the internet safer for everyone, they could chip away at the unfair advantage the net had been giving to attackers since the beginning. Chapter 12. Mudge and Dildog. Peter Zatko, known to even close friends as Mudge, was not the most engaged executive at stake, even though he was the lead creator of the Pioneer Hacker Consulting Group. The most famous member of the Cult of the Dead Cow was elsewhere much of the time, fighting his own demons, and after 9/11, America's demons as well. What he saw made him very afraid. Mudge knew as much as anyone about the basic failings of tech security and about their root causes. The internet's inventors built it on trust, and it got loose in its test version before Vint Cerf and his team could come up with reliable security. It still ran that way. All software has bugs, some of which can be exploited. Layering software on software makes it less secure. The software vendors had all escaped legal liability for poor craftsmanship and had little incentive to devote significant resources to making their products safer. This hard line on liability has only begun to fray in 2018 in extreme cases, as with deaths blamed on automated vehicles programming. Regulation ranged from non-existent in most commercial markets to negligible in industries such as financial services, healthcare, and power distribution, all of which meant everything was unsafe and would only get less safe as the economy grew more dependent on technology. This was classic market failure, compounded by political failure. One could debate the largest causes of the political failure, but they included the capture of the regulators by industries that did not want to be regulated, the dominant pursuit of short-term business games by short-term business executives, and the failure to distinguish when private companies should be responsible for their own defense and when the federal government needed to step in. That last was non-trivial. Since the same techniques could be employed by criminal hackers, fending off who would generally be considered a corporate responsibility, and nation-state spies, who would generally be considered a Homeland Security or FBI responsibility, with backup from the Department of Defense. Even if those lines were clear, what do you do about criminals who work for spies or spies who moonlight as criminals? Congress's inaction loomed large, but without blood on the streets, Mudge held little hope of that changing anytime soon. In 2003, as largely Russian organized crime groups took the leading role in spreading computer viruses for spam and extortion, Mudge saw that the big picture was about to look a lot worse. He figured the best way to help was to go to the place that had the best understanding of the problem, the most power to deal with it, and the greatest responsibility: the federal intelligence agencies. Given his sketchy associations and general anti-establishment attitude, it would have been draining to apply directly at the CIA or NSA. But Mudge could at least start where he was a known quantity, and where he had geographical and employment buffers from the people wearing braids and stars in their uniforms. A year after Mudge's top government sponsor, Richard Clark, resigned from the Bush White House, Mudge rejoined BBN Technologies. Starting in 2004, he worked at BBN on research and development for U.S. intelligence agencies, and he trained people who would become the core of the NSA's elite hacking unit, Tailored Access Operations. Over the next 6 years, he worked on a lot of things he can't talk about. "I think domestic lives have been saved as my ideas went operational," Mudge said. He told me that lives in the Middle East were also saved because his tools were used instead of bombs. In 2010, the new head of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency asked Mudge to come in-house and lead the agency's cybersecurity efforts. Mudge had thought about DARPA before, but he hadn't been enthusiastic about the agency's prior leadership. The new boss, Regina Dugan, he liked. And DARPA, founded in 1958 in response to Russia's stunning Sputnik satellite, had the coolest mission in government: the creation and suppression of strategic surprise. Like many positions inside DARPA, the post was for a fixed 3-year term, during which he would award grants for offensive and defensive breakthroughs in security. But the opportunity was incredible. This agency had steered the creation of the ARPANET, which became the modern internet. "I obviously wanted to make sure the things I depend on, that my family and friends depend on, are secure," Mudge said. "I also owe a lot to my country. A lot of countries would not have allowed me to influence the intelligence community and the Department of Defense, hopefully in ways that have them make less stupid mistakes. Mudge's personal slogan had long been, "Make a dent in the universe." Now he called in a dozen of the smartest hackers he knew to help figure out how. He told them to be ready to discuss where the security industry was failing, what they as researchers were angriest about, and what DARPA could do to help. They convened in a bland Arlington, Virginia building that housed the massive intelligence contractor Booz Allen Hamilton, the company that would employ Edward Snowden. Mudge's call brought out a bunch of misfits, said Doug Song, who was among them. The group included at-stake veterans Dave Itell, now running Zero Day Seller Immunity, Inc., and Dino Dizovi, a former Federal Labs researcher and chief scientist at government zero-day supplier Endgame. Also, there was sometime intelligence contractor H.D. Moore, who had created Metasploit, a penetration testing tool that used vulnerabilities as soon as they were disclosed, often within a day. Ninja Strike Force stalwart and intelligence contractor Val Smith came too. Mudge convened the meeting by telling them that his DARPA slot had given the entire hacking community, at long last, a seat at the table. Now, he said, let's not waste this opportunity. As they brainstormed priorities, Song asked about something different, a change in process. DARPA funded the big guys, defense contractors, other major corporations, and some university departments. Those operations knew how to navigate the paperwork, come up with slick pitches, and leverage their previous work. This left out talented small teams and individuals who had great insights from being hands-on hackers and no idea where to go from there. The son of a liquor store owner, Song, had used a small business grant to start Arbor Networks. He said DARPA should go small as well, and Smith agreed. Mudge had spent enough time around government to realize they were right, and he convinced Dugan. The process itself was an impediment, Dugan said. Mudge announced the Cyber Fast Track not long after, the first program at DARPA aimed at giving small amounts to small teams instead of large amounts to large ones. Mudge funded nearly 200 proposals, all of which let the researchers keep their own intellectual property. Among the recipients was Moxie Marlinspike, whose invention Signal would come years later, and Charlie Miller, who studied flaws in near-field communication as those protocols were getting embedded in more smartphones. At DEF CON in 2011, Miller was presenting a near-field talk and bumped into Mudge, who was also speaking. Miller told Mudge some of the things he was interested in and asked if DARPA would buy him a car he could hack. Submit and find out, Mudge said. So Miller did. He got the car and hacked away. Building on that work later, Miller hacked a moving Jeep being driven by a wired reporter, prompting a mass recall and drawing global attention to the safety issues of computerized vehicles. The initial equipment and the money was one thing, but DARPA's backing became even more important when a car company, upset at Miller's revelations, threatened to sue. Mudge warned them that if they did, the Pentagon would join the suit on Miller's side, with a significant number of well-trained lawyers. Those grants also provided a certain amount of legitimacy to the research that really helped when people were having objections, Miller said. There are lots of research projects you see around now that would never have existed without those CFT grants, including the car hacking we did. Everyone at the Pentagon wanted to get the papers explaining the research, but before they could get the briefing books, they had to sit through a demonstration by the hackers themselves, so they really understood them. In the years that followed, other areas at the Pentagon began mimicking the fast track Mudge developed. Mudge did much more than streamline the way the federal government acquired good ideas. He also tackled a fundamental problem with the way the government and everyone else evaluated security. For decades, no one had come up with a reasonable way to estimate the worth of security products, which draw attention mainly when they fail. Likewise, DARPA couldn't figure out a logical basis for determining what to fund. We are not going to approve a single new project until we do the deep strategic work, Dugan said. She insisted that Mudge and his boss, long-serving DARPA software chief Dan Kaufman, find a new way of looking at the issue. Mudge and Kaufman came up with what they called the Cyber Analytic Framework, the major concept. As predictable complexity increases, the defender's job gets harder more rapidly than the attacker's job does. To illustrate the problem, Mudge used the common language of Washington, a slide deck. The most eye-popping chart showed that the average advanced defense software had bloated to contain 10 million lines of code over the past decade. The average number of lines in malicious software, meanwhile, had held steady at 125. Since every 1,000 lines of code has 1 to 5 bugs in it, that meant big security products were making the situation worse. DARPA needed to seek simple and elegant approaches instead. It was a clear articulation of trend lines, Dugan said. Mudge began asking defensive grant applicants whether their approaches were tactical or strategic, how their project would increase or decrease the overall attack surface being defended, and how they would beat it themselves. The framework approach became the basis for DoD spending beyond DARPA, and it got DARPA some money that otherwise would have gone to Cyber Command, one of several things Mudge worked on that annoyed Cyber Command head and NSA director Keith Alexander. Mudge didn't mind that at all. Alexander had presided over a massive expansion of global and U.S. surveillance, as well as a culture that produced several whistleblowers and leakers while allowing employees to be hacked. Mudge loved betting on promising ideas, but he also considered it his duty to strangle bad ones in the crib. While still an outside contractor, he decried a product that automated some active defense. The industry term for measures that range from blocking suspicious connections to disabling the computers used by an attacker. Though hacking back tempts targets that feel powerless relying on the government, most intelligence professionals think it is a bad idea that would lead to chaos and perhaps an unintended war. Automating that is a terrible idea, because then an outsider can make you do things, Mudge said. Mudge also expended considerable energy arguing against demands for backdoors and encryption. Intelligence and military officials said that backdoors worked well in their offices, that access was logged and controlled, and that abuse was rare. But those were closed systems, where the people in charge could completely govern the environment. Out in the regular world, configurations get looser and privileged access leaks. Mudge didn't stop telling the truth just because he was at the seat of great power. It probably helped that his position would end after just 3 years, so officials expected less sucking up. Mudge briefed the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense, helping them understand when one of the armed forces or a contractor was claiming an improbable capability in a turf or budget fight. The Joint Chiefs and the Pentagon would call me in because I didn't have a horse running, and I was able to explain to them ground truth, he said. Mudge remained iconoclastic. Amid widespread outcry over the constant breaches of American defense vendors by other nations, Mudge observed shortly after leaving DARPA that contractors had a perverse incentive to allow their weapon systems to be stolen. Once that happened, Mudge mused at Black Hat, they could ask the Pentagon to pay for a new and improved version of their system that was not yet in enemy hands. Game theory is a bitch, he said. Yet Mudge managed to play the inside game well. DARPA always sent off its creations to new homes within the Pentagon or intelligence establishment where they would best develop. With Alexander and others predisposed to dislike much of what Mudge had handled, he sometimes engaged in subterfuge, handing off to a mid-level operative who could remove evidence of a project's heritage. At one briefing with the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Alexander explained that he had 5 silver bullets that he could deploy in cyber operations. 3 of those are mine, Mudge thought with satisfaction. Mudge got the Pentagon to stop seeing hackers as the natural enemy. In fact, Mudge showed that people who grew up knowing exactly where the line was were habitually more careful about not crossing it than people constantly protected by their uniforms, bureaucracy, and lawyers. During one discussion at a large agency that was witnessed by Kaufman, an employee asked Mudge if the agency could just hack into a system in order to get information Mudge was deducing. Absolutely, you could do that, Mudge told him. But just suggesting that is illegal, and it's wrong. Even within DARPA, Mudge provided a moral compass. In a fortuitous bit of timing, Mudge's scheduled exit from the government came in April 2013, 2 months before Snowden's disclosures turned the NSA and U.S. intelligence into global punching bags. On his way out, Mudge accepted the Secretary of Defense's highest award for civilian service. The citation said that Mudge's fast-track grants had produced more than 100 new capabilities, that his new method for detecting cyber espionage had been placed into operation by intelligence agencies, and that he had improved the Defense Department's ability to conduct online attacks. Mudge followed Dugan to Google, where he worked on secret projects. The best known put a secure operating system on a memory card. The software would function properly even if the overall computer were compromised. Its features included an unchangeable logging system. The software would have been among the best possible defenses to the mass surveillance revealed by Snowden. Google did not release a finished version before Mudge left for a new venture, a nonprofit to examine code from binaries. The machine-readable instructions that programs give to computers and score them based on standard safety features. Mudge and his wife Sarah's cyber-independent testing lab functioned like the labs at Consumer Reports, scanning for the digital equivalent of automatic brakes and seatbelts, all without needing access to the source code. With money from DARPA, the Ford Foundation, and others, CITL showed that on a Mac's then-current operating system, hackers would have a harder time attacking Google's Chrome browser than Safari or Firefox. Mudge aimed to make a more detailed version of such scores into something like the mandatory nutritional labels on food, telling buyers enough for them to make informed choices that reflect their priorities. Grappling with kidney cancer that brought back his post-traumatic stress disorder, Mudge saw the project through its first year, then handed day-to-day control to Sarah, a fellow veteran of federal contractor BBN. Mudge took a day job as head of security at internet payment processor Stripe, which helped pay the bills at the nonprofit. A September 2018 investment round would value that company at $20 billion. In his spare time, Mudge served as cybersecurity advisor to Senator Mark Warner, co-chair of the Senate Cybersecurity Caucus. Mudge has been extremely helpful in refining our understanding of software security, which informed our work on improving the security of Internet of Things devices. To take just one example, Warner said, referring to new classes of Internet-connected gadgets such as security cameras and thermostats. Warner also served as the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, making him the lead Democrat in the congressional investigations of Russia's hacking to help Trump win the 2016 election. It would be logical to think that Mudge's expertise aided Warner there as well, though neither man would discuss it with me. Mudge had earlier advised the Democratic Party in 2016 to tighten its security, he tweeted in 2018, but most of his advice was ignored. The other great technical mind from CDC's golden era, Christian Dildog Ryu, wound up doing something technologically similar to the work of Mudge's lab, deeply analyzing the safety of programs without access to the source code. But he went a very different route, starting with rejecting an opportunity to work for the government and ending up doing something much bigger. While with that stake, Christian spent a lot of time poring over binaries. Source code, which appears as it is written by the programmers, is 100 times easier for the human eye to comprehend, but it can also hide a host of ills. Looking at ones and zeros, though, is mind-numbing. So Christian wrote as many tools as he could to process the binaries and tell him what they were saying to the computers. That saved a lot of time while still allowing him to conduct what the industry calls static analysis of the code. as Symantec sucked AdStig deeper into itself and made it harder to distinguish from the rest of the giant company, Christian decided to create a startup to fund his quest for something of a holy grail, a program that would decompile all the binaries back into human, readable instructions for analysis. From 2006, Christian served as chief scientist of the new company called Veracode. He tapped Chris Weissopel, his colleague from the loft and at stake, as co-founder and chief technology officer. The business plan called for them to serve software customers instead of the makers, like Microsoft and Oracle, where there were incentives to scrimp on security. Once the master program worked well, Christian reasoned, the buyers could convince their suppliers to let Veracode do a safety analysis on the binaries. If they passed with flying colors, then the suppliers would cite Veracode's approval as a badge of honor and recommend that prospective customers have Veracode do a new check on the most recent software version. In theory, it was brilliant. In practice, it was a lot of work. It was a 5-year business plan that executed really well in 10 years, Christian said. One early round of funding came from InQtel, the Silicon Valley venture firm set up to serve the needs of the U.S. intelligence agencies and led by former AdStake CEO Chris Darby. Darby believed Christian would make code much more secure, and he thought Christian should deploy it inside U.S. weapon systems, making sure that the code controlling missiles and the like could withstand most attacks by hackers. Darby arranged for Christian to visit an intelligence installation deep underground and give a demonstration of what Veracode could do. A senior officer of clandestine operations said, "Hello," adding, "I'm a big fan of you guys from the loft." Christian thanked him. What a nice guy, he thought. He probably kills people. On a specially prepared laptop, Christian analyzed a blob of binary code that had been given him, perhaps a spying tool crafted by the agency. He let the program run during a lunch break and came back just as it spat out the results, describing what many pieces of the code did. Among other things, it detected a custom modification of a standard encryption algorithm. The polite killer was blown away. But the logistics of a major deal were daunting. Veracode could provide its program, but it could not be around to maintain it. Darby wanted Christian to focus on optimizing the code for such deals anyway, but Christian figured that his main customers would end up being the federal government and a few close allies. This would not be very lucrative for me, and it would have me working 500 feet underground and never seeing the light of day, Christian thought. He didn't even want to go through the hassle of getting a security clearance. More importantly, I want to have a bigger impact on the world, and I don't see it happening in the bowels of government. Once Veracode decided to stay focused on the commercial world, and Christian's team cobbled together a prototype of their master decompiler, he and Weissopel started calling old friends who were now inside the big software companies. That included Brad Arkin, an AdStake veteran who by 2008 was a senior director for security at Adobe Systems, perhaps the vendor most criticized for omnipresent software flaws in all of Silicon Valley. "Everyone knows your Flash player is full of bugs," Christian told Arkin, promising to find all the problems. "We can do a scan in a month," Arkin agreed. But the code base was a mess on a scale Christian had never seen before. In addition to regular programming foibles, Adobe had incorporated obscure encoding systems so that it could display material recorded in all kinds of formats and show them on many different devices. It kept choking the decompiler. After a month went by, Christian declared that he would not shave until he was able to complete the flash scan. That kept the pressure on him. But it still took an entire brutal year, and his face itched like hell. "I hate Adobe," Christian said. Pulling through it made Veracode's product much better. The company added big software customers, and by working through military contractors like Boeing, it could also serve the NSA and CIA. Veracode convinced software buyers to demand that their vendors allow Veracode to audit the binaries, which were stored on extremely secure computers. The first time through the ringer, most of the software providers hated it. But instead of blowing the whistle on those suppliers immediately for major weaknesses, Veracode would give them a couple of chances to improve, along with pointers about where and how to do that. Like many software and service companies, Veracode sales went up and down, with extra volatility around the end of the quarters because of the commission incentives. After the company straightened that out, and with sales approaching $120 million a year, Veracode weighed going public. The alternative was selling itself to a company with deeper pockets that could bring Veracode to more customers. The latter ended up being a better deal, and Veracode sold itself in 2017 to CA Technologies, formerly known as Computer Associates, for $614 million. It was sold and resold in the following year, the last time, for $950 million. Once installed in his new corporate home, Christian could spend more time on new projects, including one called Hailstone, which allows small software developers to test their code for security flaws as they write. While Veracode typically cost $10,000 a year, they could try Hailstone free. He quit Veracode entirely in March 2019. The largest proportion of Cult of the Dead Cow members wound up working at tech companies with people who didn't know their history. That included Luke Benfey, Paul Leonard, Matt Kelly, Misha Kubeka, and Kamal Ackman. The previously outed Josh Bookbinder still works in security in San Francisco. John Lester is in Montreal. He worked for the maker of Second Life for years, then focused on electronic tools for interactive medicine and education. Dan McMillan turned toward business, becoming a sales and consulting executive at big software companies. Glenn Kurzrock, who had always wanted to put bad guys in jail, served as an assistant district attorney on Long Island for 17 years before starting a private practice in 2017. Carrie Campbell is a freelance researcher near Seattle. Co-founder Bill Brown teaches documentary film. Co-founder Brandon Brewer, once known as Sid Vicious, is as straight as it gets. Senior vice president of real estate services firm Republic Title, based in Fort Worth. Sam Anthony went to work as a programmer in a Harvard University lab, then started graduate school there, working on biological models for computation. He earned a PhD in 2018. Along the way, he co-founded a self-driving car technology company, Perceptive Automata. Autonomous vehicles are super good at knowing where the road is, how fast the car is going, whether something's a tree or a person, Sam explained. They're miserably bad at solving the psychology problem of guessing what's in a human's head. The techniques we developed while I was doing my PhD are perfect for situations where you want machine learning to do something where humans are incredible. Sam's company took video clips of pedestrians, showed them to humans, and asked such questions as whether the subjects were acting like they wanted to cross the road. He was using machine learning techniques to teach computers how to understand people. By the Consumer Electronics Show in January 2019, Perceptive Automata could boast of investments by Toyota, Honda, and Hyundai. Kevin Wheeler kept working in music for years. In addition to producing bands, Kevin pretended he had three different record labels. He would send recordings and press releases to music publications, trying to get them to write about the bands. If any of them bit, he figured he could always pay for someone to put out a real record. That gambit didn't pay off. In 1999, he and a CDC friend moved to New York to make it bigger in music, but it was tough slogging. They did two off-Broadway soundtracks before Kevin's partner met a woman and moved to Taipei with her in 2001. Then the September 11th attacks wiped out the office where Kevin worked, and he got laid off. The biggest problem was his partner leaving, because Kevin always did better as part of a team. "I'm not an oxblood," he said. "I was the front man. I'll help promote it, spin it, make it funny. I'm at my most productive when I have a partner pushing me, like Jibe in the beginning." One other music partnership did produce a minor hit. While in high school, a budding writer named Hugh Gallagher, frustrated with unrealistic expectations for college entrance essays, wrote a wonderful spoof with CDC-style self-mocking grandiosity. It concluded, "I breed prize-winning clams. I have won bullfights in San Juan, cliff-diving competitions in Sri Lanka, and spelling bees at the Kremlin. I have played Hamlet. I have performed open-heart surgery, and I have spoken with Elvis. But I have not yet gone to college." Besides getting Gallagher into New York University, it won him a national contest, modest fame, and writing assignments for Rolling Stone. Later, he created the character of a Belgian rapper, Von Von Von, and gave a televised performance of a song at Harlem's Apollo Theater with music Kevin wrote and produced. Gallagher gave him a shout-out by name from the stage in a video seen more than a million times on YouTube. After flirting with a career playing poker, Kevin turned to trading currency from his apartment. He reverted to being the shy person he really was when not riding under a handle or promoting a cause or a colleague with onstage antics. By 2018, the cult of the dead cow had likewise faded into the background. The DEF CON and Ho performances had been over for years, and many hackers in their 20s had not heard of it, unless they picked it up from researching the past or heard about the group from older friends and mentors. Almost everyone had heard about hacktivism, even much of the general public, but they usually associated with Anonymous or other CDC successors. As with any great teacher of other teachers, the most obvious legacy of the group was the actions of those who were inspired by CDC and the next generation that they reached. That included a large swath of nonprofit activists and researchers and some of the top security minds in government and industry. At Google, security team founder Heather Adkins had grown up on internet relay chat channels with CDC and taken its disclosure lessons to heart. They had set the foundation, she said, for efforts like Project Zero. Google's wide-ranging team for finding bugs in any software and setting a three-month calendar for public revelation. In 4 years, the group found 1,400 vulnerabilities and drove 90-day turnarounds from 25% to 98%. Disclosure is more mature now, but the stakes are a lot higher, Adkins said. Companies have a responsibility to protect users. How do you show them the way? Historically, tech companies had only one goal, and that's to make money. Not until someone comes in and disrupts that does it have an impact. Those individual CDC members who were still accomplishing great things on their own, fulfilling some of the group mission, included Oxblood, Mudge, Christian, and one more person, Psychedelic Warlord. Like the others, he saw that as technology became more central to life, the critical thinking that had grown up with it likewise needed a bigger platform.